Arvind Sharma, welcome, Professor Arvind Sharma. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you on Skype. Namaste. I've been following, reading your articles and books for more than two decades now, even before I joined the academy. And I remember you were the first person to encourage me to try to pursue this career of academic study of Hinduism, Indian culture, and here I am. Also a tenured professor of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at UNT. And you are, of course, at McGill University. You have been there for last more than 3 decades now.
About 30 years, yeah.
3 decades, yeah. And then you also have taught in Australia before that.
Yes.
You had your PhD from Harvard. You were an IAS officer in India before you started your academic career. So please tell us, tell our viewers anything else you want to share on your background, and then we'll get into your latest article that you published in our first issue of our journal.
No, I think you have given a very adequate introduction.
Okay. Professor Arvind Sharma, for new students, his writings have been always very, very informative, inspiring, and so not just me, I think many of us young scholars look up to him as a role model and a very balanced and very thorough researcher and prolific publisher. He's publishing like every year a new book he's publishing. I don't know how he does it. But so recently we started a new journal called American Journal of Indic Studies, which is our flagship journal for American Academy of Indic Studies. And Professor Sharma is with us for that academy also. And he's one of the board directors in our board also. So he published a new article in this journal, and which deals with the issue of portrayal of Hinduism, Indian culture in the academy and so on. So I thought Professor Sharma can give us some glimpses or some more details on that article that he published, and he has been publishing several such articles over the last few years. So Professor Sharma, over to you.
No, you should ask me a question.
Okay. First of all, I guess what prompted you to write this article in this journal, and what was the origin or impetus to write this article?
Yeah. Okay. When I started my studies.
Mm-hmm.
In comparative religion and Hinduism.
Right.
At that time, we were not having such debates.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost midway through my career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That these kind of challenges.
Right.
To the standard paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Standard paradigm for presenting Indian history and culture,
mm-hmm.
they began to emerge. And then they gained a certain salience. And if you look at it in retrospect, it appears very striking to me that when we began our studies, the so-called Aryan invasion or Aryan immigration idea was treated as on the fringe, almost a lunatic fringe, in the field.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
This is not just, I think, a personal view, because I also noticed that Professor Basham,
mm-hmm.
In reviewing the series of books published by the Bharatiya Vidya Bhavan,
mm-hmm.
as the history and culture of the Indian people,
mm-hmm.
noted that the only reference to this perspective,
mm-hmm.
in that whole series, virtually, was in the first volume,
mm-hmm.
in the form of an appendix. With the clear indication that this discussion is being included for sentimental reasons.
Okay.
So Professor Basham described it as an apologetic attitude with which it had been included in the volume.
Okay.
And yet, as we advanced in our career, this position began to be articulated with increasing vigor, and what its proponent claimed was sound evidence, to such a point that it became a major issue, and then has remained a major issue till this day. This goes sort of surprising me a bit, that a view which had no purchase in the beginning and was not taken seriously should become almost central to the discussion. And I think Edwin Bryant's position on this issue seems to be the most balanced one at the moment, that there isn't enough evidence to call the issue either way.
Right.
So for a line of argument to reach this point in the field from being virtually absent in it was quite remarkable. It's even more remarkable to watch the progression of this movement.
We have observed this for so many
Yes. Yeah. Now, what made me participate in the debate was the feeling that the issue was not being kept within the parameters of academic discourse. And I dare say by either side. I think the most dangerous thing in academic presentations of such issues is imputing the motives of the other party.
Right, that's very, very important.
Even if we know them to be true. Now, I'm going to make what I think is a very important point.
Yes.
Even if we know and are convinced, and even we have sound objective evidence that a certain position was developed because of something the missionaries wanted to achieve in India, or something which the nationalists were aiming at in India, I think as academics, our task is to take the proposition and examine it.
Yes.
Without getting involved in the issue of motives. Now, I must admit, though, having said that, that it may not be an easy position to maintain.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the study, if you look at the history of the study of religion, you will find, as Professor Sharp, Eric Sharp suggested, that it has gone through three main stages. First, you were concerned with the materials for the study.
Right.
Of the role of religion in the history of humanity. And so you have data coming on board from primal religions, from Asia, from remote parts of the world, and so on. From the Islamic world, from the Chinese world. Then the second center of interest became, after there was enough material to explore, the method going to use to explore it.
Right.
And that became a major concern.
Yes.
And then remained a major concern for almost a decade or two. Then, motive. First materials, then method, then that motive for exploring or using any method to explore that material became an issue. And probably Edward Said's Orientalism was a major benchmark in this transition.
Yes.
So when the whole field is moving in this direction of motive,
yeah,
sense,
right,
everyone is arguing that we should not even ignore, but certain in examining the point, not use motives to dismiss the position.
Very nicely said, yeah. Great.
Because even a biased person may be telling the truth.
Yes. Yeah.
And even an unbiased person may be mistaken.
Right.
I tried in my own humble way to remind ourselves that our commitment, primary commitment as academics, remains to examining the proposition.
Yeah. It's very nicely summarized and very nicely, these three M's, from materials that we find in the field, to the methods that we study to interpret these materials, and finally the motive. And motives are the biggest problem these days, because both sides always are doubtful of the other's motive and so on. Now, yeah, and I think Professor Edwin Bryant at Rutgers University in the Department of Religion has, I think, published a couple of books on this topic, and as you said, his views are pretty balanced. So this is one of the biggest issues, I think, in the study of Indian culture that remains unresolved, and both sides are very highly charged still, and the debate's going on. That's one of the reasons that you felt that you need to publish, you need to write, you need to speak on this topic without getting into the motives part, but just examining the materials from both sides, right? That's one.
The point is actually even subtler.
Mm.
The point is that we need to distinguish between truth and credibility.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. When you impugn somebody's motive, you are really trying to undermine the credibility of the person.
Oh, yes. Right? Yes.
Okay? When you impugn the motive,
mm-hmm.
when you explore the motive, you are being a historian.
Mm-hmm.
But when you impugn the motive,
you
are trying to undermine his position, his credibility, his or her credibility.
Right.
But credibility and truth are two different things. So, Einstein proposes the theory of gravity.
Relativity, yeah.
Sorry, not gravity, yeah. I'm terribly out of date. Theory of relativity.
Yeah.
We know now from details of his personal life that he treated his wife in a way which we would consider not ideal.
Oh, okay.
Far from ideal.
Oh, okay.
If we try to connect his being a bad husband
with
his competence as a physicist, then what are we really trying to achieve if we try to do that?
Right.
That can only affect the credibility of what his position.
Right.
Or as proposing a position. But it cannot determine the truth or otherwise of his proposition.
Yeah.
So even if people don't have credibility, and this is a hard point to make, even when people don't have credibility, scholars have an obligation to examine the proposition, unless, of course, it is totally, irrelevant.
Yeah, unscientific.
And even there, one has to give the benefit of doubt to the point of view.
Right.
Because you don't want to leave any perspective out.
Right. Outrightly reject. Rejection should not be done.
I would even go so far as to say, that one should examine an issue from all points of view, including the obtuse.
Right. Yeah. So this issue itself is such a complex topic. Should we continue on this, or would you like to share what are the some other problems that has prompted scholars like you and I guess in very small humble way some of us other scholars who have also tried to speak on write on this topic of the presentation of Hinduism, Indian culture by the academics. What else are there other big issues that that has prompted you or the, and others in addition to Aryan invasion theory? What else?
Well, there is a broad issue,
mm-hmm.
Which I see now more clearly,
right,
than when I was intervening in the debate earlier.
Uh-huh.
And it is this.
Mm-hmm.
Our civilization,
mm-hmm.
what they call the Indic civilization, is perhaps the only civilization or culture in the world,
mm-hmm.
whose reconstruction in modern times,
mm-hmm.
is the work,
mm-hmm.
largely the work,
mm-hmm.
not of its own scholars, but of scholars from another civilization.
Yeah, outside. Yeah.
The Western.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So this means that even our self-understanding
yeah.
of our own tradition in modern times has been filtered through its understanding
yes.
by another culture.
Right. Yeah.
So this then means that it might be susceptible to a danger.
Mm-hmm.
This presentation or representation
right.
might be susceptible to a danger.
Right.
Two kinds of dangers, actually.
Mm-hmm.
One, that its self-understanding mm-hmm. has been influenced
mm-hmm.
by that of another culture.
Yes.
Another yes. culture's understanding of it has influenced our self-understanding.
Yes.
This is one point to be explored.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, its presentation
mm.
in general
mm-hmm.
is affected by our understanding of it
mm-hmm.
on the one hand, and our presentation of it on the other.
Right.
Both.
Both are colored by the...
Now, colored the possibilities. Now, right. I should not jump to conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
The possibility that it has been influenced,
mm.
most people would agree.
Right.
The possibility that to a certain extent,
mm-hmm.
it may have also become distorted.
Yeah.
Is what we need to look at very closely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So this is very important point, and I think this really distinguishes our civilization from Chinese civilization, I think, for example.
Yeah.
Right. So would you... When I was a student at Columbia, I remember I was looking to do some research on Al-Biruni, and I found your book. So you have studied and you published a book on how Al-Biruni portrayed India. Our portrayal... So what I'm going to ask you is that, do you think that this understanding of our civilization is influenced not just by the British Orientalists like William Jones and modern American scholars or Euro-American scholars, but does it go back to as far back as Al-Biruni or even far back as Greek people who published Indica more than 2 millennia ago? Do you think we are...
Yeah. Now, the main difference
mm-hmm.
between these three,
mm-hmm.
the Greek representation of India,
mm-hmm.
the Islamic representation of India,
mm-hmm.
and the Western representation of India.
Mm-hmm.
The main difference is that the Greeks never ruled over India, never got round to ruling over India the way
mm-hmm.
the latter two
yes.
did.
So,
we can look at what the Greeks said,
mm-hmm.
and we have our own accounts of what we were at the time.
Right.
And we can compare them.
Yes.
It's a matter of great curiosity for me always.
Yeah.
As to how another civilization looks at us.
Yes.
And how we look at another civilization.
Right.
This is extremely interesting.
Yeah.
To see how other people see us.
Right.
It's a very useful corrective also.
Right.
Of ourselves.
Right. And then,
apart from generally enriching our self-perception.
Right.
Okay.
So,
but with the Muslim.
Yes.
Perspective, Islamic perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The one difference is that they did rule over India.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had the occasion, the opportunity,
mm-hmm.
or there was the historical opportunity
mm-hmm.
of their self-understanding
mm-hmm.
influencing our own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it perhaps did.
Yes. Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what sits the modern apart from them
mm-hmm.
is that despite the Western
mm-hmm.
being a domination of India, political domination being shorter duration
mm-hmm.
than
Islam.
The Islamic,
mm-hmm.
its penetration of the intellectual life of the country has been deeper.
Mm-hmm. Much deeper and much more influential.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been because that took over the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right. in the case of the Islamic occupation,
mm-hmm.
A parallel stream
mm-hmm.
of Indic
mm-hmm.
pedagogy
mm-hmm.
continued to flow.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it even continued to flow under British occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So much more attenuated.
Much more repressed or yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
And there of course is the proximity of our situation
uh-huh.
the British to the Western. That is, it lasted for 200 years.
Uh-huh.
It meant the introduction of English as the medium of instruction
mm-hmm.
is a very important move.
Yes.
To identify.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the continuing dominance
mm-hmm.
of English in the higher studies.
Yes.
Even the actual life of India.
Yes. 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 Even today, even now.
Yeah. Even right. now.
Yes. Yes. So that was a much more influential. And
so it was probably much more influential.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, it is more proximate.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by proximate? Sorry,
What I mean by proximate is that it's historically closer.
Ah, okay, very near.
Therefore, we are influenced by it more directly and immediately.
Right, right, right. In the
we need to explore it.
Okay, okay, okay. So, in your research and your publication projects, how do you maybe compare and contrast how Greeks Or we forgot Chinese. I think some of the Chinese scholars also probably observed us and wrote about us, Fayan, Wensang. So in these four portrayals by outsiders, Greeks, Chinese, Islamic, and recent British or Orientalists, European Orientalists, would you like to speak on like comparing and contrasting?
I'm very glad that you introduced the Chinese because I'm only recently discovering
okay.
the word for India used by the Chinese.
Oh, really? What is that?
Hindu.
Oh.
And this was used by, well, this became the major word used for India after Xuanzang's visit to India.
Okay, one who walked like 1500 miles, he walked. Yeah. Right, right.
So I'll have more to say about it in due course.
Okay.
But the reason why the Chinese gets to be left out in this discussion is that there was no question of, or had been so far, now it has become a factor,
uh-huh.
a political conflict.
Yes, yes.
Being involved with
right.
China.
Such an important distinction. It's like, yes. When you say it, it sounds very obvious, but we forget to say this.
Yeah.
The Chinese were not attacking us ever. They were always like student of India.
Only now it is, yeah.
Very, very important. Very important.
And aside on the point you make about the Chinese,
please.
I've always been curious as to how the Indian monks who went to China in such large numbers and stayed there, some even probably came back, how did they look upon the Chinese imperial system? What was their reaction? Did they offer any comments, if any?
Wonderful. That's, I don't think anybody has said about that.
I mean, if I'm going to live in China and I have been feeling that Indians need to now train Hindu missionaries go to China and spread Vedanta. I think they are ready for it.
Right now?
Personally,
Oh, wow. So you think China is very, like, in a way, waiting for the Vedanta?
There's a lot of, from many sources I've learned.
Really?
Including from my colleague on the governing board.
Really?
The university from China.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. There is a spiritual hunger in China.
Really? So more than Buddhist hunger, it's a more, you think?
There is a lot, Christianity is spreading. Buddhism is getting revived. And Tibetan Buddhism is becoming very popular.
Right.
And I think the yogi Iyengar, the author of the famous Iyengar method, he has many followers in China.
In China.
Okay. He went to China and was very well received.
Oh, really? Okay. I know that Bollywood is also very popular.
It's very popular, yeah. No, but I did seriously. I think Hindus, I mean, those who are active in the, we are academics, those who are active in the field should think very seriously about sending Hindu missionaries, especially who have delved into Vedanta, to China.
Yeah, what is it?
And replicate what the Buddhist monks did.
Yes.
So, doing that. But that's, of course, a side issue.
Right.
So, coming back to, now, of course, we must add, before we leave the topic of China, that now the political dimension has become important.
Very, politically powerful, and they don't mind.
No, there is, we have to face it, there is conflict.
Yes.
Earlier on, there was hardly any.
Kind
of military conflict.
Absolutely. Right, that's a really important distinction, because Greeks came as invaders and Islamic people came as invaders, at least in the northwest part. In the south, probably they came as traders, but in the north, they came as invaders. And of course, European came as traders slash invaders, and then they really influenced us. So, what about the Greek portrayal of India? Megasthenes was one of the, Megasthenes who wrote about
it? I have a whole, I've covered this extensively in a chapter in the book, The Ruler's Gaze. The title of the book was changed by the publishers. From Orientalism to To The Ruler's Gaze.
Very recently published that,
So there's a whole chapter in it on this.
So, so now, at present, at the contemporary times, there are no direct political invasion happening onto Indian civilization or Indian country of India. But would you like to speak on other issues? Like, what are the issues that are that we can maybe discuss in addition to Aryan invasion theory, and that issue we discussed in detail, a little bit detail. Any other big issue that you would like to share, or that caused these tensions of or motive, like the issue of motive?
I think I should pursue the points we have already broached. Because that is the direction in which my recent thinking has moved. I am fascinated by the terms we use in our discourse. So we use the word Hinduism. That is not a Hindu word.
Foreign
term. Word.
Right.
We use the word caste for our social structures. That is not a word we would come up with. We have come up on our own.
Idol, maybe idol.
We use the word religion.
All the time.
We use the word history. Now, what I'm discovering is that even the words we think, because they are in an Indian language, are ours. May not be ours.
So even Indian language words?
I just learned that the word Adivasi, according to this source, was coined by missionaries.
Really?
In the early part of the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
So it always, so our own word has emerged in this, in a context in which the Aryan occupation of India, the Aryan invasion / immigration of India, was accepted as gospel truth.
Yeah, I didn't know that Adivasi.
Otherwise, the Adivasis would be the people of Mohenjo-daro and Harappa.
Yes. So,
if the identification with the Vedic texts is in due course upheld, we have no idea where it would be. And they would be the Adivasis.
Yes, yes. That we know so far. Maybe there were people even. But it seems like they might be the first ones.
In a sense, in a major way.
So
there are two things to be explored. The use of Western words and what implication they have for our self-understanding, for mediating our self-understanding.
Right.
Not like using the word distortion because it prejudges the situation. Mediation.
Right. Okay.
The mediation may be harmless.
The mediation
may even be positive.
Right.
And it can be negative.
Right.
Depending on, of course, the criteria we use.
Yes. But it has been, salient issues.
So first the words which we have used, then the words we have coined for those words.
Yes.
And thirdly, words coined in our languages which are not our own in terms of that pre-British use.
Right. Such as Adivasi and...
Like Adivasi is the one example I recently identified. I've yet to investigate it.
Okay.
Because what is becoming very clear is that the word you use is very subtle and almost imperceptible, but very tangible implications of what happens. Our self-understanding.
Yes.
Now, the example about which I am fairly confident now is the use of the word religion.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yes.
But the effect it has.
Yeah.
The subtle part of the effect it has is what I want to dwell on a bit. That to a, in a cocktail circuit in New Delhi. We'll use words like Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism as standing for different religions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, absolutely.
But the relationship between Judaism, Christianity and Islam and these Indian religions is very different.
Yes.
You can't be a Jew, a Christian and a Muslim at the same time.
Right. Impossible. Yeah.
But in pre-British India, religious identities were fairly fluid.
Yes.
Even today. In Nepal, which escaped the British census and the imposition of the British term religion, or the Western term religion on it, if you ask in Nepalese, are you a Hindu? He would say yes, he or she. And if you're a Buddhist, he or she would say yes.
Both
this has been documented very solidly.
Also in Japan, right? The same thing.
Japan, of course, is it is another dimension of the whole issue. Mm-hmm. But now the point which emerges from this is that this has happened without our perceiving it happening.
Yes.
That is, we ourselves have started
right.
interpreting our own religious reality in the way it was being interpreted by the West.
Yes.
So I think these are the kind of, if you really want to rebuild our cultural heritage, or try to align our cultural heritage more closely,
right,
what we perceive to be its earlier incarnations.
Right. Pre-British or pre-colonial.
Yes. Then we'll have to be very sensitive to these things.
Right. Yeah, I think the latest example is that Jainism is declared as a separate minority religion in India because of these issues.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Should we maybe continue in the next time, or we can talk more on your recently published books and so on?
Yeah, sure. We can. Yeah.
So I guess we'll stop here for now. Yeah. And thank you again, and really all
the best.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thanks.
Namaste.